हरि ओ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहनेयङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे.
This is the summary understanding of what Krishna consciousness is. Without this understanding, one is sure to misunderstand why the devotees are interested in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. One who is interested in Krishna becomes interested in his different pastimes and activities. This extends also then into any other subject, because you're talking about the philosophy here, the Bhagavad Gita, but you're interested in the battlefield, what's going on there, how everybody interacted, what was the standards, how did Arjuna as a Kshatriya fighting on the battlefield, how was he able to be Krishna conscious during this time? Because he's performing his occupational duties. So that would mean that if you're interested in Krishna, his philosophy that you can apply in your life, you'd also be interested in seeing how devotees applied it in their life. Right? So therefore it becomes important because the Gita then becomes the field of activities. So and then in that field is where then the devotee is going to apply it. You know? So it's very important. So many other topics are there. And we'll say, well, we don't care about those things. Yes, we don't care about them if they're not connected to Krishna. We couldn't care less about a battlefield if it's not connected to Krishna. It's not that, oh, because in Gita there's a battlefield, we're interested in the battlefield, therefore then any battlefield we have interest in. No. It's a matter of the battlefield's connected to Krishna. That's what's of interest. So if you can take another battlefield and connect that to Krishna, nice. But otherwise, it's the battlefield on its own is not what's important. It's that the battlefield is connected to Krishna. So in the same way as astrology, astronomy, if it's connection to Krishna, that's important. But if it's not connected to Krishna, what do we care? Right? Ayurveda, if it's not connected to Krishna, what do we care? But if it is, we're greatly interested. Right? So that's the whole secret of this thing, probably saying, is the summary understanding of Krishna consciousness means you can see everything in connection to Krishna, and Krishna is connected with everything. So then one is able to, at all times, all places, all circumstances, see Krishna. Otherwise, then there's going to be a problem. I heard one of our academic scholars preaching that he said the Kama Shastra is bogus. Because, why would the Vedas talk about such disgusting things? But then the interesting thing is Srila Prabhupada in the Purport, I think even in the Gita, I think it is, then mentions that the Kama Shastra is there for properly having children. So that's the purpose of it. People take it and misuse it. But that's its purpose. Right? And so that would be one aspect. Then the other aspect is, if you're having a child, conceiving a child that is supposed to be God conscious, that means that whole process is connected to Krishna. So then why wouldn't there be an importance on that process? Does that make sense? But from not understanding this point that Prabhupada's making here on Krishna consciousness, that scholar could not understand these things. Right? Simply it's disgusting and this and that. But then, what's more disgusting than the body in general? Ayurveda's talking about all kinds of digestion and this and that, and its body's made of mucus, bile, and air. Pretty disgusting stuff. Air is not so bad if it's been in a nice place. But bile's always nasty. Mucus is always nasty. So that means 2 out of 3 is nasty, and 80% of the body is water, and water in the body takes the form of mucus. So that's 80% mucus. That's 80% nasty. you know, and anything that therefore works on fire, the eyes, the blood, the stomach, I think there's five things, that's bile, right? And then air, okay, then that works in there, the movements and all that are there, it's all airs, right? But you have to remember those airs are inside the body, so generally they may not be as pleasantly, you know, smelling as if they were outside, so... So in other words, it's just nasty. So then wouldn't we say, then why would the Vedas talk about Ayurveda? Right? And then we could go on and say, in the same way, as why would they talk about, you know, Shudra stuff? You know, singing, dancing, music, all these things. That's for Shudras. So therefore, Gandhara Veda also, why would the Vedas talk about that? You know? One second. Hari Bol? Yeah, yes, not class going on. It was just to check if everything was okay. Okay, Hari Bol. So in that way, then, other than, and then any, and technically speaking, if you take this, keep going with this, then, you know, the Veda itself, all the other branches of knowledge, means there's 14 branches of knowledge accepted in the Vedic, what we call, definition. That only one of them is transcendental, right? That's your philosophy, that's your mimamsa. So that would mean all these other 13 books, generally, why would we be even dealing with that? That's bogus. So you're complaining before, why would the Veda describe this? But the Veda itself is also aparavidya, so technically mundane. So that would be thrown out. And then within mimamsa, then there's six schools, all those are thrown out. Well, generally we do anyway, but the elements of them that are bona fide, that should be known, but that should all be thrown out. So all you leave yourself is with Uttara Mimamsa. Right? So this is fine, but then the problem is then basically you could only be brahmacharis that live in the forest and chant Hare Krishna, and if anything goes wrong, all it is to chant Hare Krishna. They don't bother with anything else. Why? Because anything else would require something more, require a Ayurveda, or require some aspect, or some other ritual, or this or that, right? If there was a need, they need to get married, then that, all those shastras there, you know, the culture, the art, the administration, all these things then would be thrown out. Right? So in other words, then throwing out this one shastra, then would be inconsistent if they're keeping all the others. Either throw them all out, or keep them all. Right? But they're being kept is only if it's connected to Krishna. If it's not connected to Krishna, it has no meaning. Right? So the Vedic literature is important because of its connection to Krishna. Seeing it not in connection to Krishna, that's some people's misfortune. In other words, it's not that it's inherently not connected, so therefore the devotee's connected. No, it's inherently connected, and the devotees are able to appreciate that. And the non-devotees can't see the connection. Right? But because there's more non-devotees dealing with these literatures than devotees, therefore it appears that that's the standard, but it's not. Right? Therefore, you know, a million fools can say, you know, an untruth is the truth, but it doesn't make it any more true. Like that. Right? Of course, in your academic presentation of the statistics, then it might fall the other way. Is that okay? Okay. The definition of a pure devotee, as given by Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, can be summarized thus, right? Because now they've defined a devotee and devotional service. So now, on this last pages here, now he's starting to say this, these are the summary. So that was the summary understanding of what Krishna consciousness is. In other words, position is whatever is connected to Krishna is Krishna conscious and is important and valuable, and whatever is not is just not. So it's not a matter of this topic is important on its own. What's important is Krishna. It's that simple. So that means something that's not connected to Krishna is useless. Anything connected to Krishna is useful. That's the whole point. Then now he's giving a summary description of the devotee, because before that he was describing the devotee, how he was engaged in devotional service, you know, qualifications, attitude, everything like that. His service, okay, his service is favorable and is always in relation to Krishna, right? So then it gives those both. In order to keep the purity of such Krishna conscious activities, one must be freed from all material desires and philosophical speculation. Any desire except for the service of the Lord is called material desire. And philosophical speculation refers to the sort of speculation which ultimately arrives at a conclusion of voidism or impersonalism. Very important to note this is that, being it's a subtle point, and philosophical speculation in here in the definition refers to that sort of speculation. He's not saying speculation in general, that sort of speculation which ultimately arrives at a conclusion of voidism or impersonalism. Because in mental speculation, you're going to deal with impersonalism, which means not actually impersonalism, but with the impersonal aspect of Brahman. Because that is what you're inferring. When you're dealing with studying the philosophy, then a lot of inference will be dealt in this category. Right? So, that kind of speculation, in other words, in connection with your own understanding and the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, and you're trying to apply that on the environment around you, then it is speculation because you are using the process of inference. You are using the process of logic, right? Because you can see two items, and then you're inferring the third. Right? So you're seeing the column. You're seeing the column holds up the building. So then that would infer that the column has the strength to do that. Right? So, but the point is that strength, as in this point, is it's coming from Krishna. So the strength is actually what's holding up the building. Right? So Krishna's strength is what makes the columns able to hold the building up. Does that make sense? So that's inference. So that would be speculation. But it arrives at the point of understanding Krishna. Right? So even if it's done at its lower levels, you're understanding, okay, Krishna is the essential element in everything, and then you just start seeing the essential elements in everything, and in the process, maybe you're not remembering specifically Krishna, but it's in pursuance of that. So it's in a lower level, but it's not ultimately coming to the point that it's impersonal. Right? So that means, okay, Krishna is the strength of the pillar, then also then the ability of the floor to hold up, you know, the brightness and the light, you know, the illuminating effect of the light and all this. And in going through that, one's remembrance of Krishna might be dimmed by the fact of just being absorbed in trying to intellectually understand something, right? You know, just anything new that you do, sometimes you may, in trying to be technically correct, may miss the point or may miss the essential things. You know, you're so absorbed in riding the bicycle, you don't bump into things, that getting from one point to the next is not your focus. You know, you're more focused on not bumping into anything. Of course, it is in line with getting from point A to point B, because if you bump into something, it's not very efficient from going from one place to another. Right? But it may not be as dynamic as it can be. But as one gets adjusted with that, since one's purpose is not just to not bump into things, that's not the conclusion, it's to actually use the bicycle to get from one point to another, then you will come back to the actual proper situation. Does that make sense? So it doesn't become philosophical speculation. It's using the process of speculation, but it's not termed as such, because when we say this, we say it in a derogatory way. Does that make sense? So the process of logic is there, the jnana is there, but it's without the idea of the impersonalism, and it doesn't oppose activity. Right? And when we say karma, then it doesn't mean that we're established in performing activities of Krishna consciousness that are physically performed, that give results, but we're not desiring that result ourselves, and we're not opposed to philosophy. Does that make sense? So in other words, the ultimate goal of Krishna, the understanding of the Brahman platform, it's understanding it's not the ultimate position, and the understanding of engaging the Mahdi mind in words in the Lord's service is what you're trying to do. So, therefore, those aspects of that are controlled by karma, then those are performed. Those aspects that are performed based on jnana, those are performed. Then it becomes perfect. Then it's buddhi yoga. Right? The problem is when karma's on its own, one's not interested so much in the philosophy, because the philosophy will make it not, it's obvious that you shouldn't be engaged in fruit of activities. And, how you say, and the a result of the activities for yourself, that then makes it fruit of activity. So that karma is what we are talking about that's not good. But the performance of the activity, that's not our problem. It's the mentality that I don't want to know the absolute truth. In other words, it's the activity is not being done for the absolute truth, and the activity is mine. Right? So there's no naishkarmya. And in jnana, then the elements of naishkarmya are very important. The elements of becoming freed from material attachments and all that are very important. The ability to be appreciative and absorbed in philosophy is very important. So those are accepted in devotional service, but the activities that are not favorable is where one says that karma is useless, right? And that the ultimate personal understanding of the Supreme Lord is incorrect. Those two aspects of jnana are thrown out. So when we say, you know, the jnanis are like this, and we're saying it not flattering way, then we're meaning those who take the impersonal as the ultimate, and those who are not engaged in proper activities, or refuse to engage in activities. Right? But if you accept the personal as the ultimate, and you're willing to be engaged in the favorable activities in devotional service, someone situated in that, they're called a jnana yogi. Right? Someone who's situated in performing activities for Krishna, like that, that's called a karma yogi. So now the question is if you're looking at it from the inspirational, okay, now you're engaging these things in Krishna's service, then you're looking at the glass as half full. Right? In other words, it's good. It's moving forward. It's progressive. One will become established properly in pure devotional service. Right? But if you're looking at it from the mundane point of view, or looking at it from the point of view is that there's things that are obstacles for devotional service, then you look at karma yoga. You don't call it karma yoga. When you're saying the glass is half empty, you call it karma misra bhakti. You understand? Devotional service mixed with fruitive needs, that then becomes karma misra bhakti. It's not ideal, but it's a starting point. But in here, the glass is half empty, because what's missing is that devotional side. Right? Then when we're looking at the same thing in a positive light, then we look at its karma yoga. Then we say the glass is half full. We have connected our needs and desires to Krishna. Does that make sense? Very important to see the difference. Otherwise, if not, one will fall prey to this example of the battlefield. Is that its activities, it's useless. Right? Or it's jnana, and that, you know, that's connected with speculation, it's useless. But how many times have you heard that someone says a little philosophy and then they're called a jnani, and that's thrown out? Or someone's engaged in some activity, he's a congregational member, and he's engaged in fruit of activities and thrown out. I'm just saying, is that, anybody's heard this? Other devotees have mentioned this? So that means it may be true, and maybe what they're saying is correct. And they're pointing out the karma misra, jnana misra. But there's also every possibility that they're making a mistake and don't understand karma yoga and jnana yoga and are throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Like that. Otherwise, why is it in 30 years something so simple as establishing the Vedic principles of social life can be established? Something so simple. Right? It's not rocket science. That's the best part about it. You know what I'm saying? If it was rocket science, then it would be hard to be understood. If it was rocket science, then it wouldn't be known that women are situated in religiosity, right? Because varnashram is religiosity. And so then the principles of varnashram, the women can very easily understand. who does what, when, what other, all the etiquettes, how everybody interacts and everything like that. So if it's rocket science, why would it be something that the women would embody? You know what I'm saying? Like that. Because when you give an example of somebody who's into intellectualizing and something very, very intellectually tough, generally a woman isn't the example. You know, you think of some very academic or very scholarly, very austere person sitting in some very socially dysfunctional environment, and all they can do is talk philosophy. Then they're the guys that can discuss and appreciate rocket science, right? So, therefore, that it can't be established means we're not applying our intelligence at all. We're too overwhelmed by this point, is that we can't understand what's connected to Krishna useful, what's not connected is not. So therefore, the Varnashram, which is social system connected to Krishna, we can't appreciate because, oh, we don't get into that. It's Maya, it's the Vedic, you know, this, that. We're not into these. We're not fanatic. At the same time, is we can profess all day about modern concepts of culture and say that they're completely fine and Yukta Vairagya, they're engaged in the Lord's service. We can even have seminars on them. Right? You understand? So it means that these principles of devotional service that Rupa Goswami is talking about right here, and Prabhupada is talking about in the introduction, we haven't even touched the book yet, that means these are not understood, therefore it can't be applied. Right? That's the whole thing, because if we say, well, it's an economic system, but Veda is dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So artha is one of four. So if they're taking it as only one, that's why they can't understand. So simple stuff, because they can't see how it means the liberation. We say, get out of the material world, be freed from material contamination, go back home, back to God. What does freed from material contamination mean? Right? You just took a bath of Lux soap, or what does it mean? Right? Or if you want to be more politically correct, maybe Dr. Bronner's soap, or you know, some other organically made by, you know, people in elevated consciousness, you know. So is that understood? Then these things, it becomes a problem, is that then it's not seen that becoming freed means you're liberated. But that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is developing love for Krishna. Right? What's making you, what's the point of ever forget Krishna? You're forgetting due to material contamination. If you never forget Krishna, it means you're liberated. Right? Now the point is emphasis, always remember Krishna. Because always remember means it's favorable. Never forget means it's not connected with the material world. You know, or with the impersonal Brahman. So you've freed yourself of karma and jnana. So that means you're liberated. You know, but at the same time as then you've established yourself in always remembering Krishna, which means devotional service that is favorable. So just in that statement, this whole technical points of the philosophy are included. But we tend not to see. So therefore these things are brought out. You had a point. Sorry.
If we have any material desire within the heart, then it's karma misrubhata.
Any material desire, it depends upon what it means. Karma misra, that means there is some, in other words, something that you could engage the senses in, or something that's going to be prestigious that gives you a position within the material sphere. We can also be attached to knowledge and, you know, being freed from the material world. You know, so that would be jnana misra. Like that. You know, knowledge is more important than, you know, devotional activities or other things like that.
And in the pure state, then it's karma yoga.
In the pure state, it's karma yoga or jnana yoga. Prabhupada mentions karma yoga, you first take up Krishna consciousness, you're basically engaged the body, right? You know, it's just like I don't know if it is still anymore, but previously, you know, it meant you come to the temple, first thing is 6 months, you wash pots. Like that. You deal in all these physical activities. You're doing all, whatever it is, you're engaging the body, and it's, you know, you want a scene that one doesn't get distracted and get emotional or mental or attached that you can't do the service. So then they'll be pushing you to be physically active. Once that becomes established, then the next process you see is become a set, what is going on in devotional service, the quality of devotional service, analyzing devotional service. So it doesn't mean that the physical stops. It means that the focus on the physical is not there anymore. The focus is on the philosophical. Then that's called Jnana Misra Bhakti. Or Jnana Yoga. In this way we're using the terms unfavorable. It's not that Jnana Misra actually has to be unfavorable. It just means you're in the stage when your devotion is still mixed with knowledge or still mixed with that. So technically nothing has to be seen as unfavorable. But the tendency is because we work more on religion than we do on philosophy, because religion is sentiment. Therefore, then, anything that looks to do with that, then we don't like. Right? Does that make sense? You know, the only good Indian's a dead Indian, right? You know, so that was how the early Americans thought of the natives of the North American continent. Strangely enough, though, is that they also have this festival or holiday called Thanksgiving. And that's to do with, you know, the local Indians giving them facility and everything like that and getting them established there in America so that they could, you know, freely practice their religion that was they were being, persecuted for in Europe. So they're thankful for that and all that they've gotten from the Indians. Right. So it's interesting that, you know, so these are the kind of things that it makes it very easy. That's the point, is that you categorize to such a general thing, then it makes it very easy to then give a label to that group and then ignore it, or, you know what I'm saying? So it's very easy that if it sounds like any kind of philosophy that I don't either want to deal with or I don't know how to deal with, it's gyan. You're a gyani. Right? And if you're not willing to engage in a particular physical activity that the leadership wants you to engage in, then, you know, you're doing something that they see is separate from what they want, then you're a karmi. You understand? Rather than looking at it, well, actually, would it be better to engage them that way? You know what I'm saying? And then they can do that in connection with Krishna. Then it is under your authority. You know what I'm saying? Because the point is that the order should match actually what's happening, you know, in the present, on the ground. You know, you have the field of activity, the person involved in it, and what activities they're involved in. So if your order doesn't match that, your order is actually not useful. Just because you said it doesn't mean it's valuable. Okay, if people follow it because you're in charge, they get the benefit for having followed authority, but the authority will get no benefit. If they get any benefit, it's simply the benefit that is gotten by that devotee who followed the order, even though it wasn't actually a valuable order, and that they did it for Krishna and got spiritual benefit, so in that way you somehow or another engage them. But it'll be a lot less, you know, very minor compared to what it would be as if you were engaging the devotee according to what their nature is. So that therefore your order match actually what is actually happening. You understand? And this is standard. That not only is just philosophy, because you're not dealing in the moment, so you're not dealing with the mode of goodness, so what would be your purpose in establishing that? So it would have to be false ego or something that you're looking for in the future. You know, ultimately you may connect it to Krishna, but it's not a strong connection. But even on the mundane platform, is those who deal with mundane management, you know, like that, wouldn't actually agree to that. Right? The ruler on the battlefield, if he gives an order, but it contradicts what the man in the field, who's right there fighting, thinks should be done, then the rule to success is the guy that's doing it should do what he feels is correct. You know what I'm saying? And the ruler should accept that. So in other words, a good ruler is taking the advice of those who actually deal with the subject matter. Right? Instead of the temple president telling the head pujari what he should do, he should be asking the head pujari, since the head pujari is the one who's dealing with it. Right? Especially if the temple president wouldn't know which end of an incense stick to hold if he had to do an artik. You know, which is can be very prominently the case. But if it's not the case, the temple president does know a lot about deity worship, you know, or even knows more than the head pujari, that's even better. But it's the head pujari who's day-to-day doing the puja, so he knows the situation, what's going on. He still should hear what he has to say. And then if it's practical, use it. If it's something wrong, philosophically correct, but not practical, then he gives guidance. But still, the application has to be seen in connection. In charge doesn't mean, you know, from the point of that you're the absolute, complete, you know, maniacal, you know, authority. You know, which is, you know, a pretty common, mundane application of it. Which is very interesting, is because those who appreciate authority and understand the principle of authority, when an authority acts in a very strong, absolute way, they don't see a problem with it. If there is any problem, it'll be the specific point that they think is a problem, not the action of making a decision, pushing it through. Right? And those who themselves don't appreciate authority, don't accept authority, have authority issues, they will see it as this, you know, absolute, you know, what is it?
Absolute
power corrupts absolutely. They'll be quoting all this stuff like this, but if they get in any position of power, they will exactly do that, exactly. In fact, generally worse, because they don't have the culture of authority. Like that. You understand? So the point is that these things Krishna conscious, they apply here and they apply on the practical level. Anybody who actually understands the material world will understand that there is nothing more practical than what is being said in these books. Just these principles here of understanding these two points of the field, just understanding what a pure devotee is, even that, if you wanted to be successful in the material world, you'd have to apply it. You know what I'm saying? Success. Krishna is success. Krishna is victory. That means that the way of dealing with success and victory means you have to deal with Krishna. Now, if you're doing it for Krishna, for it's pleasing to him, then that's devotional service. You're doing it, it's not pleasing to him, then it's pious activity. But the process is the same. You know, the man has cows, he has his field, he uses the cows, plows the field, you know, he and the cows, you know, prosper in this way, and then, you know, everything becomes nice. But, so it's the way to deal with cows and land and money. Right? But he wasn't doing it for Krishna, he was doing it because he's pious. Right? Or he might even do it because all he has is land and cows, and so he's got to make a profit. But in any case, it worked because it follows Krishna's rule. Now, if you're having cows because Krishna likes cows, you're plowing because Krishna likes it that way. That's how Krishna wants the human society to work. Therefore, then besides getting the material benefits from operating, you'll get the spiritual. But the operation is exactly the same. Right? You're going to play devotional music. You still have to push the same buttons on your iPod. Right? You're just a pious person, you're listening to something that you consider as, you know, more elevating and more like that, then it's still that. You're listening to some really nasty stuff, then it's still this, you still push the same buttons. Right? It's motive passion, philosophically the motive passion, to think that the iPod will work differently for a sinful person, it'll work differently again for a pious person, work differently again for a devotee. Because it says that someone in the mode of passion sees that there are different souls. Right? So therefore there's the devotee souls, then there's the karmi souls, there's the jnani souls. No, it's the same soul. The nature is the same. That's the mode of goodness. But it's a matter of the difference in how they're applying them and the consciousness, that's all. That's what makes the difference. Same soul, change consciousness, then you get these different manifestations. Right? In other words, consciousness is in its natural state, then all souls are the same in that they all worship Vishnu. Right? Put them in their contaminated state, and then they'll come up with basically 26 different varieties of, you know, insane, mundane, methods, you know, based on karma and jnana, and any mix of them. Does that make sense? They'll come up with all these different things. But if the soul is in its natural state, they all will say the same thing. You bring a devotee from Vaikuntha, one from Dwarka, one from Mathura, one from Madhava, and you talk about the principles of devotional service, how it works, they'll all say exactly the same thing. Now, within that, what is the specific taste for worshiping the Lord? Then there'll be some difference. Like that. One went on reverence, you know, one, all these stuff. So they'll have all these different flavors. Is that okay? Yes.
The 26.
We discussed that in Tattva Vivek. There's all different breakdowns. You basically have karma and jnana as the two main things. So karma is basically means it's based in the material energy. Dealing with the material energy correctly, you will get good results, good fruit of results. You will enjoy, you'll be happy. In other words, deal with the material energy properly, and you will enjoy in the material world. Right, and the essential point or the common point of all aspects of the jnana are the material world can't make you happy, so you get rid of, you extinguish your connection with the material energy, and because the soul is seen to come from material energy, therefore you won't exist anymore, then you'll be happy. Right? Does that make sense? So then you have breakdowns of that on when you're dealing with material energy. Are you selfish in your dealing with the material energy? Are you selfless in dealing with the material energy? Are you dealing piously or are you dealing not piously? Do you see the material energy as a person or is just an energy, or do you just see it as the dead matter itself? Basically, those would be your varieties, you know, in that. Then in the others, that you have your Buddhism, you have your impersonalism, you have in the Western your pessimism, you have your idealism can function on either side. You know, it's all ideas and all that, so therefore, but still you enjoy it, or it's all ideas, so why be involved? When these two, in those states, which aren't accepting a higher authority beyond the material energy or the impersonal Brahman, when one becomes frustrated with that both of those don't work, then the natural tendency is turned to there's a supreme authority that's a person. So then in that you accept one God, which is, you say it's one God, but actually you're dealing with two, because you'll always make this mistake of separating God from his creation. Some then make it into three, right? Father, Son, Holy Ghost. You pull them up on that, you're monotheistic, then they'll say they're all the same, they're all one. Then you have those that have multiplicity of gods, that there's so many gods, but at the same time as then, if there was a multiplicity, then there would be problem. There has to be only one God. Otherwise, if there's many creators, then why would the nature of how they create match? Right, you know, you have a Ford, you have a, you know, you have a whatever it is, a Buick. The parts aren't interchangeable. They're cars; they do the same thing, but you can't interchange the parts. So, why, if you had many creators who weren't functioning under a supreme creator, why would this universe even function? Because each would do it in their own way. There would be no match. There would be no consistency. Right? And besides that, they'd each be vying for, you know, supreme power. So then they would be so busy fighting amongst themselves, as you see generally in the, you know, Greek and Roman and Norse, you know, depictions, that a lot of times they end up killing each other or, you know, sticking each other in jail or, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they need to be freed and this and that and just on and on. So it wouldn't work. Right, so Indra and this and that can fight over their position, show attitude, but the universe still goes on because Vishnu is actually the controller. He's the creator. Like that. And so like this, appreciating just the position of that there is a higher force, but you don't necessarily know how to, you know, appreciate nature. Like this. So in this way, then there's like 26 little finer divisions. But they're basically all karma and jnana. Because then in this other one, then you're approaching the person, but generally it goes back into karma again. Because you approach God that, you know, everything will go right. You know, we're out hunting,
And so then, may our rifle shoot straight, and may we be successful, and may the animal we shoot not suffer, and all this. May it all be good for everybody, So they're turning to God for all their different things. But it basically comes down to karma. But at least now they're going beyond the material energy as the source. They're accepting a supreme person, a supreme Lord as the source. But if you dig deep enough, you'll find they're impersonalists. So it's a very interesting, unique combination. I wouldn't. Means its basis is all there because of the nature of the soul. The soul understands that there's higher authority. The soul understands they're connected with that higher authority. The soul understands that their happiness is coming from being connected with that higher authority. They understand the eternal principle. They understand the principle of happiness. These are all inherent in the soul. Therefore, all philosophies will reflect these points. But the problem is they'll have all kinds of strange and wonderful methods that they come about, becoming happy, or what is the Supreme, or relating to the Supreme, or who they are. That's always going to be a problem. You know what I'm saying? So there's always an overlap, because there's going to be the thing, because you being happy means the Brahmananda, okay, you're connected with nothing, but then in the impersonal and the Buddhistic philosophies, where does the soul come from? You understand? Means in your mundane philosophies, they're all mundane, but in your, you could say, materialistic philosophies, in your materialism, then it comes from matter itself, right? But if you look at it, the impersonalists and the Buddhists are saying the same thing, because the point is there's Brahman. They'll say it's all Brahman. They'll accept the soul as Brahman. They may even have the impersonalists will say the eternal aspect. The Buddhists won't accept the eternal aspect. But they will say it's because of contact with the material energy, therefore the concept of the individual soul is generated. So even they believe in the soul being generated from dead matter. So that's common in all their philosophies. Right? And then the element of, does that make sense? So like that. Oh, also we didn't get into it. Then in the pessimism, which is your not so philosophical, understanding of your Buddhism. It's just that material energy won't make you happy. So therefore, if you get freed from this body and mind, you'll be happy. So some say it's a process that takes many lifetimes. Some say when this body is finished, it happens automatically. So basically, you get through the lifetime, just somehow or another survive, then don't worry. Then after it'll be over. So those are also further breakdowns. But does that make sense? But in all these things, there's an overlap. All of them will be saying that the soul is generated from material energy. Of these two. The ones that accept the so-called, that there's a higher God, they may say the soul is coming from God. But if you ask them to define the soul, then it ends up as the body and dead matter anyway. So then they still come back to there. Because they don't know what spiritual is, so they can't give a spiritual definition, right? They can't give a spiritual definition of God, of the jiva, of the material energy, of the process, of the goal. That's why you can't call it karma missa, but it's based on the nature of the soul, so they will never say anything really that doesn't at some point have some connection back to the actual reality, but they would not have a clue that that's what's going on. You know what I'm saying? But they'll all say the soul is coming from material energy. By dealing appropriately with material energy, you will become happy. So for the karmis, it's performing pious deeds or proper, mechanically working with it, you'll get that. For the impersonalists and that, then it will be doing the opposite, avoiding working with it. Both of them will be talking about, most of anything that works, it'll be talking about an element of sacrifice, of selfless work. So both the karmis and the jnanis will be both saying that. And they'll both be supporting that. Because it's understood that that's the best way to deal with material energy. Any result you want, whether it's fruitive or in connection with liberation, you have to deal with material energy from a detached point of view. Naishkarmia has to be applied. But whether you're seeing it as nice karma, you're just working for others' benefit, you know, from there for the fruit of result, working for others' benefit, so become free, that you don't have anything that you're desiring to become freed from attachment. In other words, you're addressing others' attachment, that's good. You're not addressing your own attachment, that's good. But both ways, nice karma will mean that. You either the lowest level, you work for others' attachment, or you don't work for your own attachment. But the highest is, you don't work for your own attachment, you work for Krishna's pleasure. Right? So both of them are going to miss that, so where's the bhakti? You understand? But they act purely on the basis, because they are spirit, soul, so their philosophy, if you break it apart, we can explain our philosophy from theirs. But their philosophy will never explain ours. He's the pure devotee, but do they understand he's a pure devotee, or do they say he's God?
Because they're not following
him. The point is also, even if you really want to get into it, what was he preaching?
Karma.
Karma, but more in the way of moralism. But his emphasis on that was in actually developing, you know, affection for God. In other words, don't be so ritualistic. He wasn't saying rituals are bad. He was saying don't be so ritualistic. Those who are ritualistic thought he was attacking the rituals and saying don't be ritualistic, don't practice rituals. In trying to be moral, he's trying to point out is that don't be so self-centered. You have to be, you know, situate yourself on the platform more on the platform of selflessness, because the point is you're if you're going to serve God, you can't be selfish. You have to be selfless. But they'll take it as it's just a very, you know, it's a nice way, pious way, and so it develops good economics. In other words, if you look at it, it would be thought amongst the community and others that someone is a good Christian or good Muslim or good, Jew, then he should be wealthy. You know what I'm saying? He should be wealthy. Because he's practicing religious, he should actually get wealth. So they're mistaking the whole point, you know. And if we really want to get, then this is general point. If we really want to get technical, Jesus was Jewish. So a real Christian would be practicing Judaism with Jesus's perspective on Judaism. In other words, a more devotional interest or application of the Judaic rituals and holidays and philosophy. That would be a real Christian. Right? But they've made a new religion which is so ritualistic. Catholicism is extremely ritualistic. Orthodox, any of the extremely ritualistic. It's the very thing that Jesus was talking about. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing. Does that make sense? Right. All of the 12 apostles are all Jewish. All those people basically that came and heard his lectures were all Jewish. Right? There's one or two, you know, goys that came, right? You know, the centurion, that's the famous one, like that. You know, he accepted, you know, so there would be individuals, but basically his mass base was the Jews. All the disruption and annoyance was amongst the Jewish community. You know, the ones that didn't appreciate him at all, and, you know, politic to get him, you know, dealt with in the way that they felt was best were the Jewish, you know, ritualistic priests. You know what I'm saying? So the point was is that if we're going to say they're coming in the parampara, nice. But we really want to get technical, it's there. But if we are dealing, okay, parampara, there's a priest, he's heard from other priests, then that's good. You know what I'm saying? That's nice, they accept it like that. But it still doesn't mean it actually comes to devotional service, because it has to be favorable. You know what I'm saying? So it's very distant that, okay, you want bread, so you're asking God for bread. Great. But devotional service generally means based on affection, on love. You know? You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like, just take it that they both have some distant connection, that's why you can talk about it. But which would you take as more, as the example of love? is that the kid going out, you know, into the backyard, picking a few dandelions and bringing that in and give it to the mother and saying, here, this is because you're so nice. Or the kid coming up and telling, telling the mom that, you know, I'm hungry, I want a cookie. You know what I'm saying? The one shows the dependence, there's a relationship, but the other one shows affection. You know what I'm saying? So that show of affection, that's devotional service. The other one, yes, they accept their relationship with God. Their position, that's very good. It's a very good beginning stage. But until they take up the element of working favorably to please God, because that's the definition is this, right? It's definition of pure devotee is summarized thus: his service is favorable and is always in relation to Krishna, right? And to keep the purity of such activities, he must be free from all material desires and philosophical speculation. Okay? Does that make sense? So, therefore, according to that, it would be very hard to define them as devotees. They're in a position to potentially be devotees. They accept God as the authority and Him as their servant. There's an eternal relationship. This world belongs to God. So everything in one sense is in place for them to take it up, but they don't quite take it up. So therefore, they're not going to get much credit for that. If they ever happen to think like that, then it would be more of the, it might be Bhakti Sukriti, but generally that has to be in touch with the chit potency. So unless they've touched chit, how are they going to get it? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But it does not that, oh, well, they're not devotees, throw it out. It's a matter of they can start from there and cultivate. You know, and as they want to know more of the science, we can teach them. Is that okay? Well, good. We got another two sentences. Today is what? Friday. So I thought we'd be finished with this. But these are basic. You understand why on this is that the whole, that's one of the concepts of how we function is that until it's really understood, because otherwise it should be, we read this and in your own mind these things are understood. Or we can simply mean, okay, well here's the position of, you know, this and that. Does that make sense? So until that is there, then these things are gone over and over again. So we may go very slowly through things. But at some point, it will pick up and be very quick. Like that. Does that make sense? Like that. So it's natural. Okay? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai.